listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine, the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
We continue on the state of England's universities today. And I was going to talk, and I'm going to talk, principally about examining. But I thought I might just comment. This is being recorded on the 6th of May, so there is a lapse factor with these. But I thought I might just comment on what's come out in the last few days. And there are two things I'd like to draw listeners' attention to. One, and I have no idea whom this is, I was asked if it was me, and the answer is no. There has been the publication by the, quote, secret lecturer, which is similar, of course, to the Critic's secret author in a way. And the secret lecturer has been revealing how appalling the situation is in English universities. He or she writes with both integrity, energy, and I might add with compassion, so we can forget about the both, because that it's three there, about the problems of teaching in a context in which bureaucracy is to the fore. And indeed, I think it's fair to say that a friend of mine, a professor elsewhere, commenting to me on my first two programs in this series, said to me, it's all very well pressing for a focus on teaching, and you were famous for your interest and commitment to teaching, but the problem is these days is teaching is overly bureaucratized. And he is absolutely correct. And that, of course, links to the other point by the secret lecturer with his or her marvellous comment that about the seniority of bureaucrats in the university sector being linked to their incompetence. What I would say, actually, having sat on a university council and followed the affairs of universities, is it's not so much always incompetence. There are actually some competent vice chancellors, as well as the time servers. It's more, I think, the problem that as people get more senior in universities, they're a bit like senior figures in the military. They aren't apt to be surrounded by people saying, is that really a good idea? Or what's plan B? Or is that going to work? Because that's not the way to get on. In fact, it's the way to be pushed to one side or sacked, in fact. I would say that that is one of the most serious problems. Anyway, the secret lecturer, clearly worth reading. And I can say from my experience, accurate as a depiction of the failings of a system, which when I went into it in 1980, was in fact, in many senses, a very effective one. We then come to the next point, which was a piece in the Times by David Blunkett, saying in effect that we shouldn't criticize universities because they are a massive earner of money for Britain. Well, they are a massive earner of money for Britain. They are very important. They contribute more to the GNP than the British motor car industry, and they are very significant, both in terms of foreign students and in earning money that way, and in terms of research and innovation and earning money that way. That does not mean, however, that they are not short of very serious problems. And of course, on those two particular criteria, while some foreign students are very important, helpful, and coming in and earning good degrees, some unfortunately are immigration dodgers. So one needs to be aware of that, and it's understandable that this government has tried to tighten up on the matter. As far as the funded research is concerned, again, extraordinarily helpful. There have been concerns more recently about the relationship with foreign powers that might not always be helpful to us, China being the obvious one. And I think that is a point. And I think the other thing I would say about research is the fact that a lot of research is very worthwhile doesn't mean that all research is very worthwhile. And Camilla Long's point in the, I think it was the Sunday Times, may have been the Saturday Times, about, shall we say, some of the idiocies of research being done on the humanities side is, again, I think, very well justified. So, but more substantively the case with reference to the Blunkett argument is simply this. Yes, the universities are tremendously important and have a potential for both raising money for UK PLC and also an enormous amount of soft power, which makes it even more serious that they have been, as it were, weakened from within by poor management, by trade union academics who've gone on strike, neglectful of their students, and by students who, shall we say, only a minority, but we see them at the present moment, some of them trying to intimidate others to share their opinion. And again, if I can add a personal anecdote, I was threatened in 2020 in Exeter because I raised questions about a issue in whether the senior management had a conflict of interest between their membership of the university, from which they drew a salary, and of other bodies that were selling services to the university. And I got threatened with the loss of my emeritus chair. Well, I mean, my response to that, on personal one, was, well, I'll go on calling myself an emeritus professor, and then they can have the pleasure of suing the most productive historian in the world. Now I'm quite happy to call myself visiting professor to the Indonesian Staff College. But the more significant point I raised was that actually the people who were wrecking the university's reputation, many of them were within the university, whether senior management or people going on strike. And it seemed to me rather odd to take the attitude that was then taken. Anyway, I think that's enough from that point. I suppose what I would say at the end is we need to move away from the bland and endlessly repeated remarks of Lord Willetts and Lord Johnson to the effect that the British university system is the best in the world and therefore should be left to itself, by pointing out that many students do not experience it as the best in the world, that quite a few academics feel that the present structure isn't working terribly well, that a vast amount of money has been spent on it, and that it's not actually evident that there has been much adequate thought about its future, other than it, the assumption that somehow more and more money is going to be thrown at it, and that is not planning. In short, the universities seem to be following the NHS, and indeed one might mention sections of the British military. They seem to be following them in, as it were, underperforming with reference to the image they like to portray of themselves, and that is being polite. Anyway, examining. Well, there's two types of examining. There are two types of formal examining, examining undergraduates and examining postgraduates. And I want to talk about each of those in order, and also to bear in mind that my experience is, I was a professor at two different universities, but Durham and then Exeter, but more to the point, I was external at a whole host of other universities, from Bristol to Sunderland, Newcastle, Anglia, Northumbria, you know, a whole host of universities. So what? How has examining changed? With the old system, there was a considerable degree of autonomy of exam boards. They were, as it were, regulated, at least in theory, by the extent to which they would have on them, and reading a sample of the papers, individuals who were supposedly senior academics from other universities, who were there in order to see that A, fair play took part, was the case, and second of all, that the marks were roughly commiserate with those of other universities. And I think it's fair to say that certainly my experience of the early and late 1980s and the early 1990s, I think it's reasonable to say that I think standards were, on the whole, maintained. I think there was slippage. The two universities that paid the least attention to the idea of having externals, what a surprise, Oxford and Cambridge, were the ones that were most guilty of grade inflation. In fact, I made a joke about the history. I was an undergraduate at Cambridge doing history. I made a joke subsequently about the Cambridge history degree that you stood a one in two chance of getting a degree because about 25% were about 25% getting first, and given that half didn't really work very hard, you stood a one in two chance if you worked of getting a first, which seemed to me to be rather poor, that, you know, you really should have a more rigorous system. But we'll leave that to one side, because as I've already mentioned, they're really the spare wheel of a system in which they are a minority and they don't set the tone. So I would say standards, thanks to externals, and externals reported independently on the exam boards to the universities. And at that stage, if an external caused a fuss, then there was real trouble. And I think it's reasonable to say that therefore professional standards were maintained. I don't mean by that that there weren't mistakes. Clearly there were. But I think if you compare the grade structure of the 80s and early 90s with the grade structure today, I think it would be difficult to escape a view that there has been an astonishing degree of grade inflation. You might say that's exactly what you would expect of a profession in which they now, I think, I remember Oxford, I think, created more than 300 professors one day. And I remember writing to a friend of mine who was a fellow there to say that I understood even the cleaners had been made professors. So given the grade inflation among the staff, it may not be regarded as necessarily odd that there should be grade inflation among the students. But leaving that aside, we're talking about examining here. And I think it's fair to say that the situation has led to an erosion of standards of late. And that actually relates more seriously to what Lord Blunkett was saying. It's all very well to talk about the quality of the British system. One aspect of quality is maintaining quality, and that means maintaining standards. And the key problem if you're teaching is maintaining standards and quality in a more mass access system. That is not helped if you simply give everybody a 2-1. And I can recall when there were already signs of trouble in this when in my career as an external. I can recall in Bristol in the early 2000s that I observed on the as external on the exam board that it seemed to be the case that the way that the history department or the history board was awarding its grades was on the principle that if you got a 2-2, you were obviously unwell and therefore you deserved an aggregate and everybody else should get a 2-1. And I said it was ridiculous. There were clearly people who merited a 2-2 and should get a 2-2. And the head of the department said to me, I can't face the parents if I give 2-2s. And I said to him in reply in front of the entire exam board, I have never heard anything so pathetic in all my life. And I think that that was a problem. There was already by the early 2000s, an idea that in some way a 2-2 was a failure, which it isn't, it's an honours degree, a refusal complete to give thirds, a on the whole failure or refusal to give 2-2s, which means that just about everybody got a 2-1 apart from a number of firsts, a growing number of firsts, and that skewed the results. Now, clearly, that was more true of some institutions than others, of some departments than others, of some years than others. Nevertheless, it was the general trend. And what it meant was throwing away a lot of the mark distribution. And if you want to sharpen it more in traditional mathematical terms, a 2-1 was a mark between 60 and 69 inclusive. A first was 70 plus. A 22 was between 50 and 59 inclusive, and a third was below a, you know, obviously they're above the pass, but a third was below that. Now, what in practice was happening is there was very, very, very little marking in those places that marked conservatively below about 58 and above about 72, which meant just about everybody got a 2-1 because of averaging. Whereas those places that, you know, quite frankly was, you know, Liberty Hall, the bottom mark might be a 58, but there were so many marks being scattered around in their 70s and 80s. Is that you ended up with large numbers of people, because obviously marks were averages. Ended up with large numbers of people getting firsts. There were also marking formulas which increased the number of firsts. So the idea of trajectory, so that people's second year marks, which tended to be less good than their third year marks, were either ignored or underweighted compared to the third year. The practice of marking continuous assessment work and in practical terms, only giving marks that went forward for the best piece of work, which again is not a accurate representation of the work somebody has done in a period of time. You also got, as another marvellous one, which inflated marks, with seminar performance, because of course seminar performance was rather like doctors handing out sick notes. Nobody was going to say to somebody, do you know, I don't really think you've made any effort, you've made no contribution, you really have failed in this seminar, and I have to tell you, I think you should be therefore looking to get a mark that is between 0 and 5%. I mean, people just didn't do that. So seminar marks were another form of inflation. So the net effect was a lack of standards, a lack of grip. And I suppose you could argue that that represented a combination of both general changes in society, to wit, fear of litigation, and to wit also a response to the idea that they mustn't cause anxiety for students, as well as managerialism on the part of universities, which wished to show that they had maintained standards by in fact giving everybody extraordinarily good degrees, this being a way to attract students. So once you have a situation in which marks on exit, as it were, are treated as proof positive of the quality of the university, let alone if you create some kind of tariff of, however implausibly, comparing mark on entry, A-levels, with mark on exit, university grades, then you can prove that you have supposedly done well, then you can give yourself some diploma or other on some sort of marking system, and no doubt the Sunday Times or other such places will label you as a brilliant university, and so on and so forth. So it was a combination of all sorts of factors. And I think on top of that, there was a degree of laziness, a degree of general cynicism, and the cynicism was one that encouraged upward marking. So I think that that was poor. And I think it's fair to say that it became less enjoyable to be an external because you were aware of a more general corruption in the system. I don't mean by that that money changed hands, but there are other forms of moral and practical corruption. And on top of that, exam boards could expect to have their decisions completely overturned if people appealed them to deans, or if indeed deans decided, or the equivalent of deans within university structures, decided they'd like to see some better results. So there were a whole host of ways of doing that. And of course, there were a whole host of practices, but enormous increase in students claiming to be dyslexic, enormous increase in students claiming to have anxiety. And the point about that is dyslexia is a real problem. Depression and anxiety are real problems. These are not helped by having large numbers of other people who are feeling under pressure, but are not actually. And I can remember when I was early days on an exam board, I started in Durham in 1980. So my first exam boards were in the summer of 1981. And I can remember a doctor's letter coming in on behalf of one student saying they were very anxious and therefore could they have a better mark. And Reg Ward, the head of department, saying, well, if I'd done as little work as they'd done, I'd also be anxious, ignore that letter. Well, that was, of course, how an exam board operated. I mean, you know, slightly more sophisticated than that, but on that, whereas these days, of course, you'd be actually debating whether to give the person in those circumstances a first or a higher first of some type or other. So that's how what I would say about that. I'd find it disappointing. I'm not arguing that it was always perfect in the past. It wasn't. But it certainly, I think, is less effective now, and it's less pleasant. An enormous amount of the work also is marked online, which has all sorts of problems and issues. Not least, incidentally, the assumption, of course, being that anonymous marking, which is what marking online is, you just get generated as a series of numbers, and you can't identify any handwriting, obviously protects the students from these appalling people, the markers. Well, that's the theory. The reality, as I certainly experienced, is it was you get all these numbers, you're exhausted, you've been marking all night because they ludicrously, even though they have more and more students, still want to deliver the marks very rapidly. So what you actually do is, shock horror, if you're not careful, enter the marks because you're tired in the wrong line. And then, of course, because it's anonymous or a number, you don't realise you've made a mistake. Whereas, of course, if you'd had names there, you would have actually known that this was a rather surprising mark from Bloggins and maybe could deserve looking at again, but you don't do that. So I actually think marking online is prone for all sorts of error. We also know now, of course, mathematical systems are going to be much more challenged, and certainly also systems outside the exam room are going to be much more challenged by AI and all the problems. Just one last point. The other interesting thing about examining was invigilating. And I did invigilating in both Durham and Exeter. In Exeter, I thought perfectly reasonably. There was no assumption that if you were the senior professor, you shouldn't invigilate. I think that was entirely reasonable. And you do see some of life's drama in that. Without mentioning any individual, obviously, I can recall on one occasion I arrived in my office in the department at 8 o'clock because I was due to invigilate at 9:30. I wanted to clear my desk. And there was a note pushed under the door from a student who'd been taking one of my courses saying, you know, no reflection on the course or on me, but he had decided not to do the exam. So I got into the departmental office. I rang the student's mobile, no answer. I rang the other number listed, which turned out to be his parental address. And I got first his rather tearful mother and then his very splenetic father, because he'd clearly written to them to saying that he was not going to be doing his exams. And, you know, I said, look, it's up to you what you can do. If you can persuade him to come along at whatever time he turns up, I will allow him to sit for as long as the exam has to run, and I will ignore completely this letter. It's up to you. But I said, I have an exam to now, to invigilate, put down the papers, that sort of thing. What apparently happened subsequently, so the head of department told me, was that in my absence, the pupil had turned up speaking to the head of department and said, why he had chosen not to do it, which essentially were matters, issues at home. The father had turned up, started shouting at the son, and the head of department had rounded on the father and told him that he was the person that had mucked up his son's life. So all of human drama there, I can, in its own little way. And of course, one sees quite a lot of, and traditionally you saw quite a lot of people under pressure, but I think also people producing wonderful work, both at Durham and at Exeter, thoughtful, interesting, reflective, and in a way marking that one felt an enormous amount of pleasure that one had helped them to think, and that they had actually been able to deliver to their own credit. So from that point of view, an enormous pleasure, even if it was a system which in my period of time, 1980 to 2020, I think definitely deteriorated. And I think there are serious issues at the present day. Examining for higher degrees, of which we're talking essentially about masters and doctorates. Well, I've done quite a lot of that. All sorts of universities, from Aberdeen, Manchester, Oxford, Cambridge, loads of London colleges, Leeds, Birmingham, etc., etc., two in France, two in Australia. If I might comment on those are very different. Each is individual because the candidate is producing a unique piece of work. Indeed, I have to do one, and I'm looking forward to it, later this month at Oxford Brookes, and I've already read the thesis, and it is an informed and thoughtful and interesting piece of work, and I'm looking forward to discussing it with the candidate, and it helps to keep one's own mind alive and alert, because you're dealing with people at the cutting edge of the research in their area. So there is an enormous amount of pleasure involved. Inevitably, they are much more complex processes, doctoral, and much more time consuming, from the actual amount of time to read a thesis to the amount of time you might feel appropriate to check some of the references and such like, to the fact that you go and have correspondence with the internal examiner prior to it, and you have to file a report. This is the normal procedure prior to it. Then you turn up for the viva, and that takes quite a time, and you want to handle it properly. So it is both fair to the candidate and also something that they will remember as being an important occasion, and also that you want to hopefully give them advice that will lead to how best to publish the work they've done. And then subsequently, there is generally another report to make, and often correspondence if you wish to recommend any changes. There are inevitably changes that you might wish to recommend or at least discuss, and those then also have to be set down. I mean, I've been vivering higher degrees from the mid-80s. It's something I've gone on doing in retirement from the University of Exeter. I've found it always interesting. Sometimes there have been problems. I can remember the London Institution where there were two external examiners, no internal examiner, and nobody to the two external examiners, myself and the other one, had two very different points of view, and we couldn't agree how to settle the matter, and that took a very long time before I was able to persuade the other examiner that it should pass. He wanted it to fail. There was the occasion when Cambridge contacted me, and they'd had a A viva in which the external and the internal, both very distinguished scholars, more distinguished in terms of the, you know, as it were, the silver spoons shoved into your mouth view of distinction, had come to very different views and then independently had complained about the other. And my instruction, for which they paid me, from the faculty board, the examining board, at a very senior level, was to that there wasn't to be another viva, that I was to read this thesis and to produce a decision on it, but also that I was to write an explanation as to why two senior academics could come to such different points of view, which was a fascinating requirement. There were the two vivas in France, one at the Sorbonne, one at Sciences Po, where, of course, the French system is totally different. A viva is public, as in anybody can come in, same in, say, Germany or Sweden. And what that means is you get all the friends and family of the candidate glaring at you. Obviously, it's in high-speed French, and it's very long indeed. The one in the Sorbonne was for a sort of upper doctorate, somebody already had a job and who was in his mid-40s, had submitted five volumes of his publications, a grand total, each about 500 pages long. And we started at 8 o'clock. He spoke for 45 minutes at great speed, locating his work in the general subject of his area. And then each examiner in turn, there were six examiners, had to spend roughly 30 to 40 minutes interviewing the candidate. And that was quite instructive. There were five French scholars, including the president of the Sorbonne and yours truly. We got one little break halfway through for a cup of coffee. The audience weren't allowed to say or do anything or leave. Then at the end, we went out. The person who was chairing the committee, Lucien Belli, very distinguished scholar, said, obviously this is all in French, pass, I think, but no distinction, whereupon everybody else nodded, I thought I'd better nod as well. It seemed, actually, I would have happily given it a distinction. I thought the chap was very good. Whereupon the candidate then has paid for an enormous party. So we had a wonderful party of champagne and lots of wonderful canapes. This started about 2 in the afternoon, maybe 2:30. And then at about 4:30, there was lunch. And it certainly is a test of one's constitution. The French system is also relatively interesting in that there are generally the candidate knows the people on what they call the jury. And there is an assumption that if you get to that stage, you are going to pass. They certainly deserve to pass after the roasting they are given. In my entire career of examining doctorates, most of them have passed. And I think that's partly because the system these days, which is not a bad one, is designed to avoid litigation and complaint, which means that it doesn't let people proceed to a doctorate or proceed beyond master's level unless they've in effect had a quite lengthy viva on much of the material a year earlier. And that actually squeezes out a lot of people. We can discuss whether that's fair or unfair. I think it's perfectly reasonable. And I can remember once at another university turning up to viva and masters, and the head of the department, very distinguished man, saying to me, what do you think of this? You know, this is beforehand. And I said, yeah, no, master's absolutely fine. And he said, I hope you don't think it was good enough for a doctorate. I said, no, I don't think of that. It's licking this, lacking that. And he said, oh, I'm glad about that. He said, because I wouldn't allow this to go forward for a doctorate, and I'm rather fearful of complaint from the candidate. So, you know, in a sense, what you're trying to do is ensure that if it's not good enough, rather than the candidate wasting time, it is cut off before that stage. And I think that is a sensible situation. There is no real equivalent from what I can see in the undergraduate level, apart from one university in which I was in the external, had what I thought was a very good idea, that if a candidate was weak, but it worked well, but the standard was weak, they wouldn't give them a degree, they would give them what they called a certificate of attendance, which was designed to show employers that this candidate was a worthy person to employ. This university was Sunderland. I was external there for 3 years. I have to say the standards in marking were exemplary. There was no grade inflation during the 3 years I was there. There was only one first, and the two ones were good and deserved two ones. I was external at the same time in Bristol, where the standards were terrible compared to that, and a sort of printing out of degrees which people didn't merit. And I think this is a point that needs to be made, because often people are very pejorative and judgmental about some of the newer universities. Some of them are terrible. Some of the old universities are terrible. Some of the new universities are good. Some of the old universities are good. It is not the actual date of foundation of the institution that determines its quality. I think that's an important point. And it shouldn't surprise us for a second. So I would suggest that it's one of the more interesting episodes. I mean, it's often, I used to say to my male postgraduates, I said, it's the only occasion in your life that people will really be interested in you. Because I said, when you get married, they're not interested in you, they're interested in the bride. But when you actually have a viva, people want to hear what you've got to say and want to ask you about it. And I'll close on my memory of a staff viva. This was at the University of Huddersfield. And the person I was vivering was Philip Woodvine. There were two external examiners, because Philip was a member of staff, older than me, in fact. And for some reason, I was chairing the committee, even though the other external, which I think was W.A. Speck, was considerably more senior to me in the profession. Anyway, I was chairing it. And at the end, I said, you know, we'd read it, we'd examined him. And I said, well, you know, I'm glad to be able to tell you that we are minded to recommend this for a pass, subject to approval by the examination board. You know, in other words, you know, we didn't actually have the right to say to somebody straight away, you can call yourself doctor. And whereupon he stopped us and said, would you mind a second? So I was a bit surprised at that. And he left the room and he came back with a large plastic bag and pulled out of the plastic bag a bottle of champagne he presented to me, a very nice one, actually, a bottle he presented to my fellow external and a bottle he presented to Keith Laybourne, who was, as it were, the internal. And I said to him, well, what on earth were you going to do if we hadn't passed you? And he said, oh, I was going to hit you over the head with this. Thank you very much, Graham.
Well, I remember my own viva very well. Happily, there was no assault. There was no audience, and it wasn't in French at any speed. But I want to start really by asking about the undergraduate exam experience, particularly finals. Just for listeners who perhaps aren't up to date, can you just explain, is it the case that in the United Kingdom all finals exams are marked by an internal examiner, which is to say someone on the department in which the candidate is enrolled, and also then marked, as you were describing earlier, anonymously and electronically by someone at another university? Does that happen in all cases, or does
No. Externals mark a sample, and internals generally now mark electronically, because papers are often submitted electronically now. So no, externals generally sample, because otherwise, how on earth? I mean, if you're thinking about it, as I mentioned, I mean, Exeter now has in history over per year over what are known 400 what are known as FTEs. FTE is a full-time equivalent. So in other words, if you've got a joint honours student, that's only a half person, as it were. It brings new meaning to the phrase cloning. There's no way that you could happily mark all of these. And there are actually interesting questions in my mind about what is going on at the present moment, because to me, the most important thing you should be doing is teaching. But obviously, listeners will know who have children at universities that many universities seem, I think this is shocking, to have stopped teaching after March. And, you know, the argument being that they need to spend the next term examining. Well, we can put a question mark against that. We can also put a question mark about why they are charging students money to live away from home in that period, or indeed charging them money for teaching. We can put question marks against that. But it is certainly the case that if done at the standards that existed 20 years ago, that marking at the present moment is an extraordinary problem, because given its scale. Now, you could argue, if you wanted to be cynical — I'm not cynical, I'm skeptical, but not cynical — you could argue that what is going on is that one reason for the inflation of honours, you know, is precisely to address this problem. You could argue that there is not always the thoroughness we might anticipate. On the other hand, there's only so much you can expect for people, and I'd rather have a situation in which staff were focused on their teaching than focused on their examining. What I think was absolutely unconscionable and very wrong indeed was for people using industrial action to compromise the exams and other marks of their students. I thought that was terrible.
Well, I just want to ask you to crystallize your thoughts on why, what are the forces that have created quite so much grade in inflation? Is it the case that when the new universities were created out of the polytechnics, they started very quickly giving a much higher number of degrees, and therefore the other universities felt they had to follow suit, otherwise going to a less distinguished institution would you'd end up having a higher class of degrees than going to a more selective one. And why is it that grade inflation seems to have happened at every institution? There are over 140 of them, and yet every single one of them over the last 20 or 20, 25 years has done this. None of them have bucked the trend.
Well, first of all, I don't accept that it is always the newer universities. I mentioned Sunderland having, in my experience, higher standards than Bristol when I was examining for the two of them. Sunderland was the new university of that type. So I don't think that's the case. And I made the specific point that there were new universities that were poor, there are new universities that are good, there are old universities that are poor, there are old universities that are good. And one can break that down to particular departments, particular members of staff, particular years. So I wouldn't like to adopt, as you're suggesting, an institutionally based thing. I do think it is a problem that there is, on the whole, a desire to show, and it's one of the points that was made by the secret lecturer we were referring to at the very beginning, who was arguing that there was pressure to do well if and to deliver good teaching grades and good exam marks, the two of them often directly linked, if there's going to be continuous assessment, and that otherwise you might compromise the future of your department. I also mentioned, as you know, that the universities that I thought were worst of all in grade inflation were the two we attended, Oxford and Cambridge. And I think, you know, they often have been giving out marks in the most astonishing fashion to people who really, on the principle essentially that if you get in there, you're obviously so brilliant, which quite frankly is not true, that you therefore deserve almost automatically a first. So no, I don't think institutional longevity is a proof of quality.
So in conclusion, what can be done to rein in grade inflation wherever it is to be found? Is there a case for saying that a set proportion in every class will get a first and so on, so that that sets an incorruptible gold standard?
Well, I certainly think, and I actually also think the same thing would be valuable at school level exams, GCSEs, A levels, and so forth, Scottish Highers. Whether it's an incorruptible one, I'm a bit more wary of. But I certainly think that that would be a very valuable start. I think there are obviously problems with subjectivity in terms of seminar performance, and I think I would probably get rid of that as a means of doing things. I think there can also be there are also practical problems. I mean, you know, for just as a technical issue for those people who do history, which both you and I did, if you pick to do a dissertation, an undergraduate dissertation, which is now mandatory in many universities, for example, Exeter, or in Durham, I was the first dissertations coordinator, there are some subjects which by their nature are going to be harder than others or more difficult to find relevant information. And that is actually going to affect your grade. On the other hand, choices that you make are choices that, you know, have consequences, and that so one could argue that that is not necessarily inherently a bad thing. But I mean, I'd like us not to end. I think there's room for one more discussion about possibly looking forward on universities, not least because it's quite clear that current issues and problems around the world, not just specifically to universities, but also in terms of funding of government, are going to mean that people are going to have to rethink quite radically areas of public expenditure. And I do think that in the case of universities, there is enormous potential, but also very grave problems. And I'm not sure I'm happy at either way of looking at things. Either you bring in government to try and sort things out, and that is a problem because government is apt to get things wrong and to be motivated by its own timetable and concerns, or you leave it to the management of universities, many of whom, quite frankly, aren't up to it.
Well, polite or not, we'll have to leave it there. Professor Jeremy Black, next episode, we will be discussing the future of universities. But thank you very much indeed.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.